Okay, thanks. Thank you very much for inviting me here and giving me the opportunity to speak. First of all, don't need to tell you that I'm a mathematician. You can see that from the handwritten transparencies. And so I'm a mathematical modeler. I'm at a place called the Centre for Mathematical Biology in Oxford. And we work on a number, there's about 20 of us all together, working on a number of different areas in mathematics applied to biology. And recently, by that meaning about 3 years ago, we got involved in modeling cancer. And partly why we got involved in that was there was an EU sort of initiative, a network, training network, to get a number of people from different universities around the EU to work together on something. And so a network was set up and we got involved in that. And what I'm going to talk about is stuff that came out of that and now is ongoing. So I mentioned in the abstract that modeling something like cancer growth is a very challenging problem because it's a multi-scale problem, similar to multi-scale problems in a lot of areas in mathematics, like in material sciences, etc. But of course, much, much more complicated, because whereas in other areas where mathematics has been used in multi-scale modeling, in many cases, the things that you're trying to model are all identical, so you can do homogenization and various things like this. But of course, in biology, you can't do that, because even two cells that are the same cell type are not identical. So it's a very, very challenging problem, and we've just started to scratch the surface of that, so this is very preliminary work, and that's what I want to talk about today. So the sort of idea of the different types of models one might try to use is that this is trying to talk about the different scales here. You've got at the tissue level, you've got signaling like tumor angiogenesis factors, which have been talked about, oxygen been talked about, various other things, nutrients, etc. And if you want to model those mathematically, you might think of using a PDE approach, partial differential equations approach. Now, if you look at the cells, cells are much bigger in scale than these elements, so it's probably not consistent to model these as PDEs as well as modeling these. So what one might consider, having said that, that has not stopped me in the past from modeling these as continuum as well and having a PDE system, and in fact you can get quite a bit of insight out of doing that. But one might think of modeling these as automaton units, little elements that are then going to react to the tissue level signaling and do something as a result of that signal. But what are they going to do? Well, at one level, you could just specify some rules. But at another level, at a more detailed level, those rules of what the cell does are going to be determined by what's going on within the cell. For instance, maybe the cell cycle, maybe molecular events going, and you might want to model these as ODEs. So this would be one way that you might try and couple the different scales, where you've got the tissue level signaling, signaling to the cell to do something. What the cell will do will depend on its internal state. By doing something, the cell will modify the tissue level signaling and the macro scale, and that will again affect the micro scale. So you have this sort of feedback. And the work I'm going to talk about today is work done by a former postdoc of ours, Thomas Alacon, in collaboration with Helen Byrne and myself. And part of it's appeared in Journal of Theoretical Biology, and another part is about to appear in Journal of Theoretical Biology. So it's a very simplistic model, and basically the outline of it is what we're going to try and do at the tissue level signaling is we're actually going to talk about oxygen, and we're just going to look at the effects of oxygen on a group of cancer and normal cells. So one thing we need to find out is the distribution of oxygen. And we're, again, going to be very simplistic. You saw a picture of this morning. This is a schematic of it, is of looking at a piece of tissue that's got hexagonal vasculature, So this might be the liver, for example. As was pointed out this morning, this is nothing like what a cancerous, the vasculature and the cancer would look like, but we're just starting with something that's simple as possible. I'm going to make it even simpler by just having one inflow and one outflow. So the question is, if you've got blood flowing in here and coming out there, how do you determine the oxygen distribution in this piece of tissue? Well, you've got to first of all determine the flow, the blood flow. So you have, for example, you have to have a pressure difference for there to be a flow. And then you've got stuff flowing in here, and then you meet a branch, so you've got to split off into these two branches. So you use this sort of formula here for the flow. You've got a pressure drop across the whole network, which is given as the sum of the pressure drops across each little bit of it. And then we're going to, as was mentioned this morning, assume Poiseuille flow, which is fine if you've got big vessels. It's not such a good approximation if you've got small vessels, but that's just one of the approximation simplifications we're making here. And the last thing we need to know is this thing mu. Mu is the viscosity of the blood. Now, blood is a very complicated liquid, fluid, and one of the typically how what it looks like, the viscosity, how the viscosity change as a function of the radius of a blood vessel looks something like this, typically. So when the radius is very large, it doesn't matter if you make the radius larger, the viscosity is still the same. If the radius is very small, the viscosity is very large, especially when you approach the limit where the radius is about the size of a blood vessel, of a blood cell. But in between, so rather than this being monotonically decreasing, you sort of have a bit that goes down like this and goes back up. This picture also depends on the hematocrit, which is the amount of the volume of red blood cells within the tube, and this will move upwards as the hematocrit increases. Here is just a non-dimensional unit. Okay. And I don't have the units offhand, but that's something that you know you can find what it is. Now the other thing, so when you've got with all I've described in that transparency, you can actually work out the flow. There is one other thing that we take into account, and this is really what we're trying to look at. With this particular model, we're actually focusing on what is the effect of modeling of the vasculature, in other words, the adaptation of the vasculature. And we're using this model here, which people have used in the past. This looks at the radius of a blood vessel at time t plus delta t compared with the radius at time t. And what you find is they're not the same. The radius at time t plus delta t will change depending on a number of factors. The first factor here we'll just talk very briefly is the shrinkage thing. If there was no blood flowing down a blood vessel, the blood vessel would eventually collapse, atrophy, and die. Now, blood vessels turn out that they need a mechanical stimulus and a metabolic stimulus in order to survive. So it turns out this is the mechanical stimulus here, and this has been modeled by people like Praise et al., that this is the mechanical stimulus that a blood vessel really, you can get this from data, from curve fitting. This is the sort of, if you like, the default wall shear stress of the blood vessel. So if the actual wall shear stress is too large or too small compared to that, the blood vessel will change, the radius will change accordingly. Basically what we're saying there is that if more blood is flowing down the blood vessel becomes wider. At the same time, if this is the flow and this is the hematocrit, then this two things together give you an idea of the amount of nutrient or the amount of metabolites that are going into the system. Now, the blood, the tissue requires a certain amount of nutrient, and if there's not enough nutrient for the tissue will signal to the blood vessels, and the blood vessels become wider. That's modeling. So those are those two. Now, there are other effects that occur that affect the radius. We're just taking into account these two things plus the shrinkage. So now what we need to do when we've got that, we need to model what happens at the bifurcation to the hematocrit. As far as I know, that's not clear, but some experiments on what happens if you look at beads in a flow, what you find is that basically if you come to a branch, so this is the parent vessel, two daughter vessels, the amount of beads, and therefore we'll extrapolate from that to the amount of hematocrit that flows down each vessel is proportional to the velocity of the material within that vessel. Now, once you've got those things, you can then start to do the algorithm for structural adaptation. And how we do this is the following. We start off with a certain amount of hematocrit within the system. We specify the difference between the pressure drop. That enables us to calculate the flow rate. So we're given this initial configuration. We use the Kirchhoff's law, which basically said that the amount of flow in the parent vessel splits into the daughter vessels. From that, we compute the distribution of the hematocrit using the result in the last transparency. From that, we use the structural adaptation thing to update the radius of each vessel. We then compute the viscosities using that little graph that I showed, and then we repeat. So we keep on going until we reach a steady state. Once we do that, we then present a graph that's virtually impossible to read for you to look at. I'm sorry about this. The detail of this isn't important. All this does is, remember, I had these hexagons, which were the blood vessels, and all this picture does, for example, is it gives you the radius of each of those blood vessels. So, for example, the blood vessel here has this radius. The blood vessel over here has this radius. So you get a sort of picture of the radii of the blood vessels, the flow rates, and the hematocrit. Having got that, then we now work out the oxygen distribution. So we're assuming that the oxygen is being carried along the blood vessels. The oxygen then diffuses out of the blood vessels into the tissue, and then we're modeling that the movement through the tissue as a PDE, and it's the exact same PDE that Shiv showed this morning, which is this one here. So we make the assumption that this is happening on a fast time scale, so there should really be a d by dt here, but we put that equal to naught. P is oxygen concentration, this is diffusion of oxygen. We assume that oxygen is being used up by the cells. So a certain amount is used up by normal cells, a certain amount used up by cancer cells. This is just the diffusion out of the blood vessels. So with that, we get our oxygen distribution. And now we've got our oxygen distribution, we ask the question of what do the cells do in response to this oxygen distribution? So we've now got the tissue level signaling of the oxygen. Now the cells are little automata units. They're going to respond to this based on rules. We start off now with very, very simple rules. And the simple rules are the following. The cells attempt to divide at each time step. So how they attempt to divide is that they sample the oxygen concentration. If the oxygen concentration is above a certain threshold, they'll divide. If the oxygen concentration is below that threshold, we say that the cell dies. That's for normal cells. For cancer cells, we bring in one other aspect of it, and that is quiescence. So for cancer cells, if the oxygen concentration is above a certain threshold, they'll divide, proliferate. For cancer, if the oxygen concentration is below that threshold, the cancer cells will not die, they'll go into quiescence. And they can stay in quiescence for a certain length of time, after which they will die. But if during that time the oxygen level goes up again, then they'll divide. So once we do that, in fact, for this particular simple model, we know most of the parameters. We actually don't know the parameters of these oxygen levels, the threshold levels, because we've just made that up. So what we can do is we can analyze the model in terms of varying those parameters and see what results you get out. Now here's a typical result that one gets, and again, these are quite, I'm sorry, I apologize about the fact these are quite difficult to read, but the result I want to get across to you is much easier to see in the next transparency. So now we've got the blood vessels are these things in white. Black is empty, dark grey is cancer, and light grey is normal. So here's a situation where we just throw some cancer cells into there, and then we solve using that cellular automata model. This oxygen distribution, now we change the color scheme, but basically what you see is you see the cancer cells growing. And so you can make lots and lots of pictures like that. The result of those pictures, this is the key thing we want to look at, is this. So this is time below, and on the vertical axis is the number of cells. And what you see happening is you get the cancer growing up and reaching a steady state. In fact, it looks a bit like logistic growth that Shiv talked about earlier this morning. What we're actually doing at the minute is to try and analyze what are the growth dynamics that are coming out of this to see if we can use an ODE model. And here's the quiescent cells. And what happens is in these particular simulations, the normals go to zero. So the question we wanted to ask here was, what is the role, or what's the effect of this adaptation mechanism, the structural adaptation, the fact that the blood vessels will change their radius depending on all these different cues. Now, the fact that the blood vessels change their radii and everything, that was a major contributing factor to the heterogeneity in the oxygen distribution. And a heterogeneous oxygen distribution was what gave us this. So now the obvious question to ask is that suppose we took that same amount of oxygen and distributed it homogeneously throughout the domain, then what would happen? So this is what would happen. So there's the oxygen distributed nice and homogeneous. Remember, each one of these things, this is the blood vessels are sort of going around here, so this is the oxygen in the tissue distributed nicely uniformly throughout the whole thing there. And what we find is exactly the same result. Cancer cells grow, they reach a certain saturation. Quiescence grow in a certain saturation. Normals go to zero. Okay? So from this we conclude that the heterogeneity has no effect whatsoever. But except we haven't actually looked at the scale in the vertical axis. And if you look at the scale, you see that the scale in the homogeneous level is an order of magnitude larger than the scale in this level. So what this is suggesting is that the heterogeneity actually has a large effect on the ability of the system to sustain a kind capacity of cancer cells.
Is it only the scale?
Sorry?
Is it only the scale, you mean? That the difference between two places are the scale of that one? Can it just multiply by some number?
No, that's where we're actually trying to analyze at the minute what are the growth laws in the two different things. So it's not that this is exactly the same as this, just 10 times bigger. At least we're not sure that that's the case. We haven't analyzed that. Yeah, Roger.
What are the threshold levels for these cancer cells and these normal cells?
Well, obviously, these levels that we get will depend on them. But the fact that this is much bigger than this won't depend, as long as we use the same threshold levels in each case.
So if you reverse the order of threshold levels, you'll get the same picture?
No, if you reverse them, obviously, then you'd get the normals winning, because the normals would have the would be better, would be the better competitors. So you have to have a situation that the cancer cells can go into quiescence. That's the key thing here. And as long as you have that, if you were to totally reverse it, it would be that you'd call the normal cells cancer cells and vice versa. It's the quiescence that allows the cancer cells to win out here. We haven't done that. I'm going to come on to that. At the minute, we don't have that affecting the radius of the cancer cells, of the blood vessels. At the minute, all we've got is the structural adaptation of the system is simply due to the mechanical and the metabolic stimuli, and then the cells, so the mechanical stimulus is due to the flow, the blood flow. The stimulus from the tissue comes due to the tissue needs a certain amount of oxygen to survive. Okay, but later on I'll talk about the fact that we're going to say that cancer has a different effect on the blood vessels to the tissue, but not at the minute. We don't have that in. Okay. Now, one thing, actually just to relate a little bit to what you've just said here, is that in the heterogeneous case, the oxygen distribution looked like this. So you have large areas of hypoxia. Now, what would happen in real life, if this has got anything to do with real life, it's another issue, is that cancer cells, of course, where there's hypoxic regions, would start to produce growth factors to try and increase the vasculature. Now, that we haven't brought in yet by saying that the result of these parts here is that new blood vessels grow. What we've said instead is that as a result of this here, VEGF is produced. VEGF goes through exactly similar sort of equations to the oxygen, PDE equation, distributed across the whole region here. Let's assume that the result of VEGF is that it increases the radius of the blood vessels. So now we've got an additional term into the increase of the radius of the blood vessels. If you do that, then you find that this level becomes higher, but it's still lower than in this case. So it does seem that the effect of heterogeneity is to produce growth conditions that are not as favorable for the cancer cells as the case of homogeneity. Now, we talked about cell division in this, and the cell division model we used was a very, very simple thing. Couldn't be simpler. You just had a threshold. If you're above it, you divide it. If you're below it, you didn't divide it. You didn't divide. That's just the result of that thing there. But what we then did was we got on to how do we model the cell cycle properly. Another reason for doing that is, of course, that certain drugs target cells only if they're in a certain part of the cell cycle. So we'd really like to know which part of the cell cycle the cells are in. So we are now going to look at this level. So this would be the level within the cell. So this would be an ODE model. Some of the reasons why we'd want to study the cell cycle. Now, there, as Shiv mentioned earlier on today, many, many models for cell cycle dynamics. We're going to focus on a very simple model of Tyson and Novak, which really, their first model really wasn't a model for the cell cycle. It was really a model for the transition between G1 and the S phase. Okay, and once you go through there, then you go on and you divide. And basically, they said in their simple model was that there are these two families of proteins, and they interacted with each other, and basically, they oscillated, and as you followed the level of these proteins, that told you where you were on the cell cycle in terms of going between here and here. And so the idea was that if you had high oxygen concentrations, everybody's happy. This is the transition from G to S phase, goes from when the green line goes from being high to low. Quiescence would mean that you actually stay stuck up here. And this is what cancer cells undergo due to hypoxia. Hypoxia and just arrest would be that you stayed in here for quite a bit of time before you made the transition. Now, I'm not going to go into the detail of the Tyson-Novak model, but basically it was something like this. Two equations, F and G, some functions of these two things, but the mass was included here in this equation. And the null clines of this system, so these are the green, G equals naught for the second equation. This is F equals naught, the first equation. And the way their model worked is the following. You start off when M is very small, so M parameterizes the G equation. So G looks like this. So you've got one steady state, which is this one, and it's stable. You look at the values of this and the values of this at this point here, and you see that that's characterizing the G1 phase. As M increases, so they had a little equation for M, logistic growth. As M increases, G changes such that G moves across like this. So now you have a situation here where you get bistability. You get a new stable steady state coming in, which corresponds to the state, the transition from G1 to S. But because you're here and that's stable, you stay there. Let M increase further. You go to there. System comes like this. That steady state disappears, you go down to this steady state. So now you've made the transition, the G1S transition. And then you'll go on and you'll divide. Division means M, the mass changes from M to M over 2. So you come back to here, and then you go through the same system again. Now they've gone on and looked at more detailed models of what happens further on, but we're trying to look at the transition from here to here, so we'll take this model. We want to try and understand what happens in quiescence. Why is it that cancer cells undergo quiescence, normal cells, under certain conditions of hypoxia, will not go? Some experiments on mouse embryo fibroblasts show that normal cells will go under hypoxia and have G1 arrest, but this doesn't occur when you screw around with something called P27, which is a protein. What could that be telling us about the system? Well, we then looked at a word model of Gardner et al. Of the effects of P27 due to hypoxia, and from that we ended up coming up with this model, where we say, let's now take the model we've just talked about, the Tyson-Novak model, and now let's put in the regulation that occurs with P27. What we're going to say is that P27 inhibits one of the proteins, so we put a minus KZ in there, and now this is where we say the difference is that P27 is switched on when there's low levels of oxygen. P is oxygen, and that term comes in there. Now we're going to say that in normal cells, P27 is regulated by growth. So as M increases here, this term decreases. But in the cancer cells, it's not. That's the hypothesis we're going to make. And having made that hypothesis, we're going to find out, as a result of this hypothesis, do we have the situation that in our model the cancer cells will undergo quiescence but the normal cells will not? So we're saying that the key thing here is that P27 is growth regulated in normal cells. It's that growth regulation is lost in cancer cells. But hypothesis, it could be wrong. It's known that if you add growth factors then in normal cells, you reduce the level of P27, the action in cancer cells, you don't. So that's consistent with what we say, what we use to make our hypothesis. What that tells us is the hypothesis isn't a totally stupid thing to have made, but doesn't tell you that it's right either. Anyway, we now solve the system again, and what we find is, now here's our oscillating proteins. This little region here, where this one is high, corresponds to the G1 phase, and what we find here, as we go from here to here to here, we're decreasing P, the oxygen concentration, and what we find is that the G1 phase goes up, and that agrees with experiments, so you're getting hypoxia arrest. But look what happens with the cancer cells. As oxygen goes down, the G1 gets wider, but then you go to quiescence. And you can the model is simple enough that you can actually understand this by using a bifurcation analysis. So under the hypothesis about the growth control and regulation of P27 being different in one type of cell to the other type of cell, we've shown that within this model, the normal cells would exhibit hypoxia induced arrest. The cancer cells would give hypoxia induced quiescence. Another thing that comes out of the model is when you compute the model, you find that these are the levels of P27 that are predicted in the normal cells up here, in the tumor cells down here. So the model would say to you that having lots of P27 is good, not having lots of P27 is bad, and that's consistent with what's known experimentally. So the last thing I want to talk about in the last like 2-3 minutes is what is the use of this model? So what we've done so far is by taking the simplest possible multi-scale model, we've used that to test the effect of, explore the effect of heterogeneity, and we found how that greatly affects the growth dynamics of the different cell types. We then said, well, okay, we did a very, very simple model of cell division in that. So let's look at more complicated, more realistic models of cell division. And in the process of doing that, we've come up with experimentally testable prediction of how P27 controls how P27 is modulated in one cell type versus the other cell type. But of course, we've missed out all sorts of other things in this. There's no mechanics in here. I could give such a big list of things, but the conference has to finish tomorrow. So I wouldn't be done by tomorrow. But it's a start. The last thing I want to say is, what about possible application? And one of the possible applications we've looked at is the effect of treatment of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. This is with a group in Israel using doxorubicin treatment. So now that we've got this blood flow that's going through here, we can say, right, let's put a drug into that blood flow. So then you can talk about the pharmacokinetics and the pharmacodynamics of the drug as it moves through the blood flow, as it diffuses and then moves throughout the tissue. And then you can talk about the effects that it has on the cells. So, for example, it kills proliferating cells. So what you could do then is go back into the model that we've talked about. You could now say, right, let's have that model of the blood flow, oxygen flowing through there, the drug flowing through there. Let's have our little cells, our little cellular automata, all solving those ODEs, so that any one time you know exactly which cell is in which part of its cell cycle, and then if a cell is in a susceptible part of its cell cycle and it's hit by a sufficiently high concentration of doxorubicin, it'll die. Or that would take a huge amount of computation. Another way you could do it is you could say, well, let's go to the tissue, let's try and get some idea of what are the durations of the different parts of the cell cycle. And then let's just impose that as data within the model and solve it that way. Another thing that I should point out in this thing is it's known, for example, that when you've got in the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, probably this is also probably true in other cancers as well, is that when the cancer cells surround the vessel, it actually makes the vessel much more leaky. It pushes it to a much more immature state. So this we can build into the structural adaptation model. So of course what's going to happen in that situation is flow through a blood vessel that's surrounded by this type of cancer is actually going to that flow is going to be very bad because that blood vessel is not going to be very good at carrying the blood along. So that we can build into structural adaptation by just saying, okay, if you're also surrounded by lots of cancer cells, basically you're as a conducting pathway, you're screwed, and we can build that into the system. What we can do then is explore different protocols of treatment, and this now relates to questions asked earlier on, is that we know, for example, that presently with doxorubicin, a 21-day cycle is employed. So can we, at this stage, use this model to say, well, you shouldn't do 21 days, you should do 10 days, you should do 15 days, you should do 50 days. This is where the problem arises, because as you vary the parameters, the results are going to depend on the parameters. So what we now need in order to get this model to really work, I mean, the model can give some sense of what happens in terms of the application of, you know, you're applying this as a periodic pulse every 21 days or whatever. You can then say, well, let's try and link that in with the rate of proliferation in some way. So what would happen if we always hit the cells just after they've proliferated or just before they've proliferated? We can do experiments like that mathematically and see what the results are. But in terms of then making a concrete prediction as to exactly what you should do, I think we still need a bit more data. But this is the general sort of area in which we're trying to go with this model. Of course, I should also mention that there is the question of all these other things we've ignored. What effect did that have on this model? But we've tried to build the model in such a way that a lot of the parts of the model where we have just at the minute put in a rule, then as more becomes known about that phenomenological rule, more data becomes known, we can develop a model for that and slot that in and make things become a bit more realistic. So the conclusion is that heterogeneities have a profound effect within the confines of this model, within the assumptions that have been made in this model. We conclude that heterogeneities have a profound effect on tumor dynamics, effects of P27, possible mechanism, efficiency of drug treatments and how we can address that. What are the future directions? Well, there's still the 9 million processes that we've ignored that need to go in there, and a lot more needs to be done, but it's a start. So thank you for your attention.